Welcome back to the second hour of Issues, Etc. First up in this hour, our interview with Dr. Randy O'Bannon of National Right to Life. Front page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. Researchers are doubtful on fetal pain relief. The story is about this study on fetal pain published by today's Journal of the American Medical Association. That interview with Dr. Randy O'Bannon first, then we'll be joined by Bob Leko. We'll talk with him for the remainder of the second hour about the teachings of Joel Osteen. Joel Osteen was on Larry King Live. As I said in the last hour, he committed probably the biggest faux pas a Christian minister could commit on a national television program. When asked the question about how a man gets to heaven, he basically passed. Pleaded ignorance, repeatedly saying, well, I don't know. Muslims go to heaven? I don't know. I'm not one to judge. Now, later, the Reverend Osteen did issue an apology and clarify his statements. But at the time, he found it hard to say that someone who didn't believe in Jesus wasn't going to heaven. Found it very hard to say it, even though Larry King was trying his hardest to get him to say it. Then in the third hour of the program, we're going to hear some audio. A recent survey has concluded that if you go to church, the more often you go to church, the more likely you are to support the war in Iraq. I want to hear from you. Why do you think this is? Why do you think it is that, generally speaking, church-going evangelicals support the war in Iraq? And do you think they would if it weren't a Christian Republican sitting in the White House as commander-in-chief? That's the third hour of Issues, Etc. Earlier today, we talked with Dr. Randy O'Bannon, director of Research and Education for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C., about today's Journal of the American Medical Association, a seven-page article therein on the study of fetal pain relief. I began by asking Dr. O'Bannon, is there such a thing as fetal pain?
I think so. I think that there's very strong evidence for it. We know that all the different sorts of anatomical necessities are there by the time of at least around 20 weeks. When you have the brain beginning to take shape as early as 18 days, pain receptors starting to show up around 5 weeks, the cortex begins to develop in 6 weeks and develops through the 18th week, the thalamus, which is important for transferring the impulses, by 8 weeks, your nerve tracts by 14 to 18 weeks, and then so you have all those parts in place. So I think that you've got this exactly what you expect to see if you have those parts in place, that the whole sort of pain transmission process and the structures needed to do that are there. And so I think that this is something definitely that women ought to be told about if they are considering undergoing a later abortion.
So what does the study that is described in today's Journal of the American Medical Association about fetal pain, what does this study conclude?
Well, now, it's very interesting. I think a lot of people are interpreting this as they think study. They think it's in the Journal of American Medical Association. They think that these people have gone out there and done some research and different sorts of experiments on pregnant women and their children. That's not what happened here. What you had was it's a group of doctors and researchers from the University of California at San Francisco, who have simply done a literature search. They've gone through and I guess used a computer and simply done a word search with different sorts of information about pain and fetuses and so forth, and collected the articles that they saw in the literature on that. And then they have looked at that and interpreted that data to come up with this particular conclusion. And they've done so using an unusual sort of standard, and that being is they're trying to say that that you have to be able to demonstrate consciousness of pain, and then they go on to say things like that a person has to can only develop this through experience. And this is a rather remarkable and different sort of way of measuring pain than people use. Like, for example, if you were to take your dog to the vet or something, and or if your dog comes in whimpering and limping, dragging its paw, the dog cannot talk to you about his conscious experience of the pain, but you're able to infer from both the reaction his behavior that he has been injured. This is exactly what people find when they looked at unborn children in the womb. They're able to find that they have the full anatomical structures necessary to feel the pain, and they react to various sorts of noxious stimuli or to the presence of an instrument by drawing away sharply. There is the increased presence of stress hormones, all the signs and symptoms of what people normally go through in pain. The only difference is they can't verbally express to you that they're in pain, but every bit of their behavior tells you that that's what they're going through. So it's a completely different standard that they're operating with here, and when you talk to pain researchers in the field, they're actually somewhat stunned by this.
Now, so let's make this absolutely clear then. The article in JAMA doesn't actually report on any new research regarding fetal pain. It is simply a literature search by various researchers of kind of the consensus, and then they draw some conclusions from that literature that you find questionable.
Well, I mean, I don't even think they have consensus here. They aren't reflecting any sort of consensus. If you see the different people that are quoted in different newspaper articles, they're not claiming there's consensus at all. These people are simply putting their gloss on this material, a lot of it which doesn't make any sort of claims anywhere at all like what they're doing here. They're just saying, well, we looked at it and we decided that pain had to involve this particular conscious expression of pain, and so we've decided that it can't be until this point. The statements that they make, for example, about the function of the cortex having to be at 28 weeks, that's not necessarily any sort of consensus opinion on that. There's plenty of people, including a doctor which has specifically addressed this in some detail, Dr. Anand from the Arkansas, who has done research on fetal pain and so forth, who says that this is just ridiculous. I think he told like the Associated Press, he said this is going to inflame a lot of scientists who are very, very concerned and are far more knowledgeable in this area than the authors appear to be. So he thinks they just don't know what they're talking about. Something that people don't realize, they just automatically say, okay, this is a group of a multidisciplinary group of doctors and researchers, and that they don't connect this with the particular institution they come from. The University of California at San Francisco has long been a leader in promoting abortion as a part of medical education. And the people are not aware that the perhaps the lead researcher on here is an abortionist. And she works at a place called the Women's Options Center that performs, according to a San Francisco Journal article from 2004, March 2004, performs 2,000 abortions a year, about half of them during the second trimester, and about 600 of those during the 20 to 23rd week of pregnancy. So there's somebody here that has a definite sort of vested interest. There is definitely these people come from a group that has an agenda. They've long been in the promotion of abortion as part of medical training. And to act as if this is simply an objective sort of analysis based on some sort of new research really covers over a whole lot of stuff that people ought to be aware of.
Also noted in the press from Knight Ritter's news agency that the lead author of this JAMA article once also worked for NARAL Pro-Choice America.
Right, definitely. And you'll find that a lot of the sort of what you might call abortion researchers, there are plenty of them that come from this whole sort of University of Southern California at San Francisco institution.
So the definition of pain in this JAMA article sounds to me, from a layperson's perspective, to be a definition designed to exclude the experience of pain by a fetus.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's going beyond what you might consider a sort of a basic sort of scientific definition of pain, and turn it into a whole sort of subjective thing. Now, there's certainly a subjective element to pain, and that's something that we're all very much concerned about. But that's when you're dealing with science or you're dealing with medicine, you're going to operate on the basis of measurable sort of criteria, and on the sort of measurable criteria, That's where people have said, what we have here, we have the structures that are necessary, we have the response that are necessary, we see the whole sort of even chemical sort of responses that we expect to see when we see the experience of pain. The fact that it may or may not go through the exact same way that it goes through in an adult is not an indication that a child isn't experiencing pain at this, and might even be more severe. What we know is there's even reason to think that it may be more severe for a child, especially in this sort of weeks between 20 and 30 weeks, than it would be for an adult, because they have a higher pain receptor density, and the pain inhibition responses that we develop as we get older don't begin to fully develop until about weeks 30 or 32. So if anything, there's a very strong possibility that the pain is even more severe for children during this stage rather than less.
I must wonder also, Dr. O'Bannon, how relevant is the issue of fetal pain? Even if it were proven conclusively that the fetus cannot feel pain, that would not change what's happening to the fetus, a living human being, in the act of abortion.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that we would all of a sudden feel better if we found out that our murder victims typically gently lulled their victims to sleep with lullabies before they murdered them. That wouldn't solve the problem at all. The issue is still the fact that a human being's life has been destroyed, and that doesn't change here. What I think it does show is the utter callousness of the whole sort of abortion industry, which doesn't have any sort of regard for the humanity or for human dignity at all in this whole sort of practice.
Now, also noted in the press, at least in our newspaper here, was proposed legislation in the Congress, the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act. What would this proposed act call for?
I'm not actually on the legislative side of things here. I work in the educational side, so I can't give you direct information on that. My understanding, though, is simply that it asks that women be made aware of this and of the research that is there and of the conclusions that a lot of scientists have come up with, that they be offered anesthesia in the case that they decide to go through this. It's simply saying that women have a right to be informed so that they won't come to be traumatized when they later find out what sort of agony that their child may have gone through because no one considered it worthy to share the information with them.
So then finally, when someone picks up the paper today and reads, "Researchers are doubtful on fetal pain relief," that's our headline, what should they know truthfully about the JAMA article?
That it comes from people with a very definite agenda who have not really done any new research but are promoting something that is very much consistent with protecting their whole sort of agenda and sort of shoring up the abortion industry.
NRLC.org is the website for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C., NRLC.org. Dr. Randy O'Bannon is Director of Education and Research for National Right to Life. Dr. O'Bannon, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd.
Coming up November the 11th, it's a Friday, there's going to be here in St. Louis probably one of the best bioethics conferences, not just aimed at the scientist or the medical technician or the doctor, but at you and at me. It's the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis, Friday, November the 11th. Among the guests are some of the very best in bioethics and the very best guests that we have here on Issues, Etc. as well. If God willing, we will be broadcasting live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th. For more information, go to our website. You'll find the logo there on our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. It's Friday, November the 11th at the Westport Lakeside Chalet here in St. Louis, the Image of God Bioethics Conference.
You know, for nearly 30 years, they've crowned champions in the sports field in this building, but I believe for the next 30 years, we can crown people champions in life. We're going to let them know that they are victors and not victims. We're going to let them know that they can do all things through Christ. And really, our message is a message of hope, it's a message of victory, and it's for all people.
That's Joel Osteen, pastor of Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, inaugurating their new worship center, the former home of the Houston Rockets there in Houston, Texas, seating tens of thousands. He expects to fill it up, and he expects to move to a bigger venue. Who is Joel Osteen, besides a best-selling author, pastor of the United States' largest megachurch, now media entity? Who is he, and what does he teach? We're going to talk about the teachings of Joel Osteen. Bob Leko is our guest. He's a former Word Faith pastor. He's co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit, and he's author of an article in the latest Truth Matters newsletter titled Osteen's Ignorance. Bob, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Pastor Todd.
So how recently did Joel Osteen come to your radar screen?
Well, he's kind of been on the periphery of our screen, so to speak, just because of his father, who was John Osteen, who was very well known in the Word of Faith movement and authored many books and the usual umpteen tape series. We have quite a few of them. So when he passed away, we certainly were informed of that, and then we knew that his son, Joel, had taken over the pulpit. And after that, we began to sort of do some research into Joel's background to see what type of credentials he had or what sort of calling he believed he had from God to pastor. At that point, even when he took it over from his dad, a very large church of approximately 9,000 members. So it was already a mega church when John Osteen had passed away, and it's done nothing but grow steadily since Joel has taken over, which, of course, many of his followers and supporters take as a sign from God that God is pleased with Joel, and that's why his church is growing so rapidly.
Is there any doubt in your mind, Bob, that Joel Osteen has followed in his father's footsteps, not only in taking the pulpit of Lakewood, but also theologically in his father's Word of Faith teachings, the prosperity gospel, the positive confession teaching?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if some of the listeners were watching Larry King in July, Joel was on Larry King, and Larry asked him, frankly, a lot of very good questions that Joel sort of danced around, but in one of the questions, Larry King did ask him, had he attended seminary? Joel said, no, he didn't, but his answer was, I didn't go to seminary. I have a lot of great friends that did, but I didn't. I did study 17 years under my dad. So in other words, the sum total of Joel Osteen's theological and biblical training are derived from the teachings of his father, and his father was solidly a Word of Faith teacher, and he did believe in the whole prosperity business, the whole impartation of spiritual gifts through the laying on of hands, all of these sort of trappings that go along with the health and wealth movement. So that's the sum total of his education, is what he learned from his dad.
And yet there is something different about Joel Osteen than the other very popular Word Faith teachers nowadays. Joel seems to have, and this perhaps really goes to the whole substance of your article, or one might even say the lack of substance in Joel Osteen's answers that you highlight in the article. Joel seems to have softened the edges of the Word Faith movement. He seems to have combined the Word Faith teachings with a kind of a church growth strategy or mindset that sets him apart in some way.
Oh, absolutely. If it's possible, Joel can be accused of dumbing down the Word of Faith message to a degree that it is more easily entreated to people who are not necessarily signed gift / charismatic / Pentecostal believers, but are just your seeker-sensitive type Christian who doesn't speak in tongues, but you know, is not opposed to it. It's just something that they don't claim to possess. So Joel has really made a sort of a syncretism between some of the Word of Faith concepts along with the church growth seeker-sensitive type marketing strategies, and he's really created sort of a unique entity, and one that is apparently very popular, seeing that he's got, according to their statistics, 30,000 members. And I think it's going to be a pattern that's going to be followed in the future by other charismatic ministries, because they're seeing it working in Joel's church. And of course they would say, well, God's no respecter of persons. If he's going to give Joel Osteen 30,000, then, you know, why can't I, as Crefro Dollar in Atlanta, Georgia, have 30,000? And begin to sort of soften some of the hard edges of the Word of Faith teaching and add in the very, very appealing message of the seeker-sensitive church.
A couple days ago, I think you forwarded me some email from people who had read something that you had written recently on what you called it the Leaven of Lakewood,
yes.
Joel Osteen's teaching. And you kind of said, you know, here's some typical rhetoric in defense of Joel Osteen. How do the devotees of Lakewood and of Joel Osteen, how do they react when you say, look, here's a guy who has taken what was already an aberrant theology and, as you say, dumbed it down quite a bit so that people may not even realize what they're getting?
Exactly. We get more emails from people about the article on Joel, and soon the article I've just written for the August issue of Truth Matters will be up on the website as well. What offends people is they say, well, look, Reverend Leko, what's your problem? You're just jealous. Joel has this largest church in America now, and it's obvious because it's the largest church that God is blessing him. He's a nice guy. He's friendly. He smiles a lot. He preaches a very positive message. So what is your complaint? Well, I have a lot of complaints, frankly, and I think they're not against him as an individual. I have absolutely no doubt, Todd, that Joel is very sincere. I'm sure he is a very nice guy. I mean, if you sat down with him and had lunch or breakfast or something, you'd find him a very personable individual. But that doesn't mean he's equipped to pastor a church of any size, let alone the largest congregation in America. And I always am challenged by the fact that I deal pretty forthrightly with the fact that he has no formal biblical education. And the responses generally are, well, you don't need that. You don't really need, you know, the disciples of Jesus, they were called ignorant and unlearned men. So you don't need to go to seminary. And I'd simply remind people that the apostles were with Jesus for approximately 3.5 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Obviously, no break for Christmas or Easter at that point. They were taught by God the Son. They were taught personally by God. And if you do the math, it works out to more hours than are required today for a Ph.D. Bob, so the apostles were not ignorant and unlearned men. That's what the Pharisees called them as an insult. But they were far from ignorant and unlearned. They were highly trained. And so I just use that as a refutation for those that say you don't need to go to seminary.
All right, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk more about the teachings of Joel Osteen and his appearance on Larry King Live with Bob Leko.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Carl Fakencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Recent developments have sparked debate as to whether the Senate should continue to discuss legislation that would mandate federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. A Harvard study suggests that stem cells can be reprogrammed to act like embryonic stem cells. Another study has concluded that embryonic-like stem cells can be developed from umbilical cords. Terry Phillips sorts it all out.
Focus on the Family's Kerry Gordon Earle says the recent Harvard study, which suggests that stem cell hybrids are possible, still requires destroying human embryos.
What we would say is move forward in trying to develop that type of a system, but only use adult stem cells. We don't want the use of any embryonic stem cells because at some point an embryo was destroyed in that.
Another study on stem cells from umbilical cords from NASA and the United Kingdom is very positive.
These cord blood stem cells do have embryonic-like properties. And again, that reminds us that we don't have to destroy human life in order to get that type of flexibility in the stem cell.
Because of these new developments, Jim Backlin of the Christian Coalition is urging the U.S. Senate to drop any further debate on funding embryonic stem cell research with tax dollars.
There have been exciting new developments in stem cell research, and we feel, Christian Coalition feels, as a result, that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist should delay the vote or cancel the vote altogether.
And if the embryonic stem cell bill comes to a vote, Backlin is hoping the new developments will cause some senators on both sides of the aisle to change their minds and vote against funding. Senate sources say the new findings may not stop debate, but could give pro-life senators more ammunition for changing its direction. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Some are suggesting that passage of embryonic stem cell research will be harder because of the new discoveries. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton for Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky, inviting you to listen to Wrestling with the Basics, Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO. We take a conversational and rather casual approach to Bible study on Wrestling with the Basics. And if you missed the program, remember you can catch it on demand on our website at www.kfuo.org. Wrestling with the Basics with Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky. On AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. regular guests David Adams, Ken Sherb, Al Schmidt, Ron Feuerhahn, Cameron McKenzie, and Mark Sell have all contributed to our Book of the Month for August, titled The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. More information about The Anonymous God is available on our website, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040 for The Anonymous God.
Coming up in 25 minutes, we'll talk with Dr. Roy Harrisville of a reform group within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The group is called Solid Rock Lutherans. We'll get his reaction to the recent General Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, where they made a move closer toward the ordination of active homosexuals to the pastoral ministry and the blessings of same-sex unions. Although if you just read the newspapers, you might not realize that step was taken. We'll find out what he has to say coming up in about 25 minutes on Issues Etc. in the third hour of the program. Bob Liko is our guest for the next 25 minutes. We're talking about the teachings of Joel Osteen. Bob, what was your general impression of Osteen's interview with Larry King?
Well, I was very disappointed by it because Larry King, for anyone who's ever watched him, and knows that he has had every major Christian leader on his television broadcast at one point or another, whether it's, he's had Billy Graham on numerous times, T.D. Jakes, Kenneth Copeland, Tammy Faye Baker, Jerry Falwell, person after person that you can think of, and here comes Joel Osteen, Mr. Rising Superstar, best-selling author, packing out stadiums all across America, and Larry asks him, well, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, but he says, well, do you believe that Jesus is the way to heaven? And Joel punts on this very basic question. He says, well, you know, Larry, I believe in Christ, and Jesus is the right way for me. And then he goes, well, King says, well, what if, and I am quoting, if you're Jewish or Muslim, you don't accept at all. Osteen, you know, I'm very careful about saying who would and wouldn't go to heaven. I don't know. King, if you believe you have to believe in Christ, they're wrong, aren't they? Osteen, well, I don't know if I believe they're wrong. I spent a lot of time in India with my father. I don't know all about their religion, but I know they love God. And I don't know. I've seen their sincerity, so I don't know. I know for me and what the Bible teaches, I want to have a relationship with Jesus. So Larry King's asking a very simple question. You know, if you're a Christian, are you saying Jesus is the only way? And if so, then other people are wrong. And Joel should have said, that's right, Larry. That's what the Bible teaches. Jesus said that I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And he meant what he said and said what he meant, and I believe that. So, you know, everyone needs to get with the program. He doesn't do that. He says, Jesus is all right for me, and I've seen other people in other religions, and they're sincere, and they love God too. So he leaves it open-ended that Jesus is okay for me, but if you're sincere and love God in your religion, well, that's okay for you. And he does the same thing when Larry asks him about same-sex marriages and abortions. He says, well, I don't agree with it, but, you know, I don't judge. I don't go there in my sermons. So, in other words, I may personally be against same-sex marriages, but I'm not going to take a moral stand and be public about my beliefs. And that's what he did throughout the entire interview. He just would not come down solidly and give a clear definition of the gospel. He would not take a stand for Christ and his unique claims as being the Savior of the world. He just didn't do that. And later on, he got so much mail and emails from his followers, he did put a short apology about three paragraphs on his website stating that after he reread the transcripts and heard the broadcast again, that he realized he might not have been as clear, but that he really did believe Jesus was the only way. He just didn't want to alienate anyone.
Now, see, I got to wonder about this, because if you took any of the other kind of general stock of characters from the Word of Faith mm-hmm. movement, if you took Kenneth Copeland and put him on Larry King, I don't know if he's ever been there or not, but if it would be very interesting if he were. But if you put him there, and Larry King said, Reverend Copeland, is Jesus the only way of salvation? I have no doubt in my mind that with a steely gaze, Copeland would look back and say, absolutely, Jesus is the only way of salvation. And there is no salvation apart from him, period. What's the difference here?
Well, Joel said in his apology on his website that he and Lakewood deal with such a wide diversity of people that they did not want to, or he did not want to offend anyone or put a stumbling block in front of them. And to me, again, that's akin to being ashamed of the gospel, because Paul was very plain in his writings and stressed the fact that we are an aroma of life to some, and we are the stench of death to others regarding our testimony for Christ. And we should be unapologetic about that and tell people, you're right, Jesus is the only way. That's what we believe. That's why we are Christians and not Buddhists or Muslims or Unitarians. And I think that Joel is just trying to appeal to as many people as he can. And what he's offering them, I'm really unclear about, because he's not offering them the Bible. He's not offering them the Jesus of Scriptures. In fact, in the same interview, he talked about the fact that he does not use the word sin in his messages, and he also does not use the word hell. Well, Jesus used the word sin and sinners, and he preached more about hell than heaven. But for some reason, Joel doesn't want to go there because, in his own words, we're not about condemning people. Well, people are already condemned. They're born sinners. They're under the condemnation of God. They're alienated from him. They need to hear the good news. And Joel is not providing either law or gospel to these people in his messages.
So what is your real concern here? Because it sounds to me like we've got a guy who is willing to say, well, I personally believe that Jesus is the only way for me. Do you think that Joel Osteen was being honest at that point, was caught off guard? Do you think that he believes that Jesus is the only way of salvation?
Well, according to his apology, I'm going to accept that as a genuine statement from his heart. And, you know, according to the way he wrote it, I'm going to accept it. I think that he believes that, but I think that he is just simply so ill-prepared to really minister the Bible, because he really doesn't know very much about it, that when Larry asks him these very simple questions, he's flummoxed by them. He doesn't know. He's like a deer caught in the headlights. He just sort of stands there and is like, well, let me see now. I know what I believe, but because I am a sort of this new brand of seeker-sensitive pastor in church, I don't want to turn anyone off. So I've got to answer this very politically correctly and just say, well, Jesus is okay for me, but what you believe is okay for you, but you're still welcome to come to Lakewood, and you know, hopefully they might learn something more about Christ through going there. So I think that's what happened. A, he really didn't know how to give a good explanation of his faith, and B, he didn't want to risk turning off anyone, which is almost the unforgivable sin in the seeker movement, is to ever say anything that brings conviction or makes people feel bad about their immorality, perhaps, or whatever the issue may be. They just don't want to go there. And Joel's a student of that. He is an expert of not dealing with anything that is controversial.
What other concerns did you have as you watched Joel Osteen being interviewed by Larry King?
Well, I was very surprised, really, when it came to this whole thing that he's doing now, where Joel is going to these different large venues across the country. He's going to 20 of them this year, and he charges people to come and hear him preach, I guess, at these meetings. And a caller called in, and I had the very question, and the person said, why do you charge for going to these conferences? And Joel's answer was, he hates to charge. And then, frankly, I believe he told a lie, because he said that Madison Square Garden demanded that he hold a ticketed event there, and so he had to charge, just $10 a person to get in. Well, anyone with half sense knows that Billy Graham has been holding meetings there forever, and he's never charged a penny for anyone to come to his meetings. In fact, there are none, even Benny Hinn, as, in my opinion, money-loving as he is, doesn't charge people to come to his miracle crusades, nor does Copeland or any of the others, not even Joyce Meyer. None of them have a cover charge to get in. And all Joel had to do was simply pay the rent on Madison Square Garden, get, the X amount of tickets, and then hand them out, and then when those tickets are gone, you shut the doors. Madison Square Garden was not demanding that he charge people. He decided to do that, or his handlers decided to do that. And so we did a little math, and it looks like he's going to bring in about $10 million this year just from doing these preaching engagements, if you will. And, of course, he'll sell his books and his journals and tapes and videos and all of that stuff as well to the people. So he's going to make out quite well. And I was troubled by that, because even these other people that are out, in quotes, preaching, don't charge people. They do receive an offering, and then people give, as they feel impressed to give.
I got to wonder about this, because by his own admission, he doesn't want to turn anybody off or put an obstacle in anybody's way, even to literally a fault, where he refuses to speak the truth about people's sin because he thinks it'll turn it off. He refuses to speak the truth about Jesus being the only way of salvation for sinners because he thinks it'll turn people off. But he doesn't think a $10 cover charge is an obstacle to anybody. It doesn't sound very seeker-sensitive.
No, it doesn't. And I was just flabbergasted that he, you know, had the audacity to do this. And then Larry King said, well, do you charge people to come to church? And he said, oh, no, never, Larry, never, not at Lakewood. We don't charge anything at Lakewood. So I don't know if these meetings are evangelical, in quotes, in nature, whether he's there just talking about his best-selling book with the hopes of increasing more book sales. I am going to be writing his church and sending them a registered letter because I want to know where the profits from these meetings go. Do they go to Mr. Osteen? Do they go back to Lakewood? You know, who's benefiting from the millions of dollars that this is bringing in? And I think that's a fair question to ask. But he said, I don't like charging. Well, then why do you do it, Joel? If you don't like doing it, you've got millions of dollars. Your church is millions of dollars. Freely you've received, freely give. But apparently that's not part of the mode of operation, so that bothered me. Of course, I was supremely bothered by the fact he couldn't or wouldn't give a clear defense of Jesus Christ and his unique claims. But I'm also troubled, Todd, by the fact that apparently 30,000 professing Christians are interested, willing, and desirous in that area by his church in the Houston area to go there and sit under this man. That concerns me for the general condition of the body of Christ, that they don't demand more from their pastors, that these people are not receiving any kind of spiritual meat, and they're happy with it. They enjoy this. Their ears are literally being tickled by a very charismatic, smiling, seemingly nice guy, and they love it. They're eating it up, and yet they're not getting anything more than what I'd call a spiritual Twinkie. And so that tells me a lot about the condition of the American church, I'm afraid. It's not good news.
Talking about the teachings of Joel Osteen, Bob Lico is our guest. He's a former Word Faith pastor, co-founder of Discernment Ministry International based in Detroit, and author of an article in the latest Truth Matters newsletter titled Osteen's Ignorance. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You mentioned before the social and moral issues, wherein again he kind of took a pass on Larry King's program. But one could say, all right, I'm not gonna stand up here and try and talk like a politician, but this is what the Bible says. Did he do even that?
No. In fact, Larry's questions were, how about issues that the church has feelings about? Abortion, same-sex marriages. Osteen replies, yeah, you know what, Larry? I don't go there. I just, King. You have thoughts, though. Osteen, I have thoughts. I just, you know, I don't think that a same-sex marriage is the way God intended it to be. I don't think abortion is the best. I think there are other, you know, a better way to live your life. But I'm not going to condemn those people. I tell them all the time, our church is open to everybody. Well, come on now. All Joel had to do was say, Larry, the Bible is very clear on the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. And marriage is between one man and one woman, living in fidelity with one another, till death do they part. You know, that's simple. He didn't go there. And I understand that, sure, as pastors, we're not out to condemn people. As I say, if people don't know Christ, they are already under condemnation. They need to understand that Christ has come and has paid the price for them, a price they could never pay by all the good works they could do in a million lifetimes. Jesus has come and borne the penalty for their sins. But Joel doesn't want to go there. You know, I just don't go there. Well, he needs to go there. That's his obligation and responsibility as a pastor, is to be a leader and to tell the people what the truth is concerning these issues that we do face every day in school, in the marketplace, on the job, on television, our newspapers and magazines. These are very prominent issues, and they need to be addressed biblically, and the Bible has answers for them. But Joel didn't give those answers.
Do you think his followers, who probably watched him with bated breath on Larry King Live, his first appearance there, Do you think they were surprised at some of the answers they heard?
Well, I'm sure they were surprised about his statement that when he went to India with his father on a few occasions and he saw the Buddhists and the Hindus and he saw their sincerity and he said that they loved God too. I think that is what prompted his letter of apology on his website, because so many of his followers, also probably potential buyers of his best-selling book if they already haven't, began to write and email and call the church, and it prompted Joel to make a little more of a clear statement of his faith. But I think that troubled them, and I give them enough applause there, because they should have been troubled by those statements. They're very troubling. And he should come back on Larry King and make a formal apology, since that show is global, and say, look, I didn't make my position as clear as I should have. And just tell Larry and all of his watchers that Jesus is, in fact, the only way. And not put it on your website for a week or two and then have it disappear, and you just keep moving on as though nothing's happened. But I think for the most part, his followers probably enjoyed and agreed with everything he said, because if he said it once, he said it at least four or five times that he's not into condemning people. Well, if you're living a life that's not a biblical one, not one that's conducive to God's holiness and what he desires and requires of us as believers, you'd be very comfortable in his church. You know, if you're going to sit there and you're never going to be told anything about sin or what God requires of us and the dangers of immorality and things, then you can live very comfortably in this kind of lukewarm environment. I like to go to church, and I like to be challenged by the messages. I like to be told the unvarnished truth, and if there are areas of my life, and there are, that are not correct, and I'm not perhaps living the way I should be, I want to know about it. And then I can get on my knees and ask for God's forgiveness and seek his grace to give me strength to do better in these areas. But if I'm never informed that there are any areas that may need work, how am I going to grow? I'm not. And so he's got 30,000 people that are not hearing a true biblical message, and they're quite content with it, and that grieves me.
When you were in the Word Faith movement, Bob, I think you would probably testify that you knew where your preacher stood. There was not a lot of doubt in your mind as to what he believed, and what he was teaching you is fairly cut and dried. Do you think the average Lakewood member knows what it is Joel Osteen believes? Do you think they know what it is they're being taught there?
Well, I think they do to a degree. I think what they know is that Lakewood is a church where we are accepting of everyone. Okay, on the surface, that sounds very good. Everyone should feel welcome to come to our church. I believe that they would say that Joel is a very positive and upbeat person. And, of course, as you've played on your broadcast in the past, his little preamble he has before each service, this is my Bible. And, you know, I believe what it says. Well, that's great, but then you have to actually teach and preach from that Bible, not cite a verse and then tell stories for 20 minutes, which is basically what Joel does. There is no in-depth teaching. So I think the people there know what they're being taught. What's sad is they're not being taught anything. So what they've learned is a lot of nothing, a lot of feel-good, pop psychology, I'm okay, you're okay, how to live the American dream, how to become prosperous and become a success in life is basically the sort of messages he preaches, and that's what they learn. They're not biblical messages necessarily, and they really will not cause a person to grow in the likeness of Christ. And these people don't know that, though. That's the sad thing, and that was my problem in the Word of Faith movement. I knew what I was taught, but I wasn't taught how to discern truth from error. I wasn't taught sound biblical principles. And so, yeah, I knew what I was being taught, but I was being taught garbage. So I knew garbage. Garbage in and garbage out. And sadly, that's what's happening at Lakewood.
So what does it say to you that Joel Osteen, his ministry, Lakewood, has a track record of phenomenal success, at least by the numbers. That place is growing and plans to get bigger, and there really does, at least as far as any of us can see, there really does seem to be no end in sight. What does that say to you?
Well, it tells me that the church in America has grown very, very lukewarm regarding biblical truth and the whole area of theological understanding. We have, for the most part, as a culture, sort of cast that away. We've bought into this sort of egalitarian mindset that, you know, this is what we want to do, but if you want to do something else over there, that's okay. In other words, the whole belief system of truth is relative, and what we believe is true for us, and if you believe something different, well, that's okay, you can believe that. So that's where I see a lot of the church culture at, sort of this malaise, if you will, of just simply wanting to go and hear something that's pleasing to their ears, that doesn't demand them to really humble themselves before God and seek His grace and the means of His grace to change and be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. They don't want to hear those kind of messages about the cross and perhaps suffering for the sake of godliness, as we are told in the Bible, those that desire to live godly in Christ will suffer persecution. That is not the American way. That's not the American dream, any kind of suffering or persecution, so we won't go there. And that's where the church is at. And, you know, I'm glad to see that there are other groups within the body of Christ that are holding the line, and there seems to be, you know, a good, in quotes, remnant of people that still desire the truth of God in its fullness and are willing to take a stand. And in many cases, we're the minority. Programs like yours and, frankly, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I mean, we're in the minority in the American church culture.
Bob Leko can be found by going to our website. All you got to do is go to issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Look over on the left. You'll find a link there called Links, and you'll, by clicking on it, get a direct link to Bob Leko and Discernment Ministry International, or you can call them, area code 313-446-1761. For more information on how to receive Bob's Truth Matters newsletter, 313-446-1761. Bob, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
Keep up the good work. Bob Leko, a former Word Faith pastor. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Roy Harrisville about the recent General Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Hour 3 is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.